Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 14th of November, these are our main stories. The impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump has heard testimony that the president cared more about Ukraine investigating his rival, Joe Biden, than the country itself. There's been further violence in Gaza, with, as we record this podcast, 23 Palestinians reported to have died since the assassination of a militant commander. Also in this podcast, Saudi Arabia says a government video describing feminism as a form of extremism was a mistake. And
I was so happy to come back, but I wish I did not. The stigma is killing me slowly.
The plight of migrants from West Africa who fail to make it to Europe and end up back home. The impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump has heard its first public testimony. Mr. Trump is accused of improperly seeking help from Ukraine to boost his chances of re-election next year, something he denies. And on Wednesday, after weeks of closed witness statements, key people started to give evidence in front of the cameras in Washington. The Intelligence Committee Chair, Democrat Adam Schiff, opened proceedings by setting out the case for impeachment.
If we find that the President of the United States abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, or if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, must we simply get over it? Is this what Americans should now expect from their president? If this is not impeachable conduct, what is?
Meanwhile, President Donald Trump didn't seem too concerned by the day's events, insisting that he'd taken no notice of the impeachment hearing.
I did not watch it. I'm too busy to watch it. It's a witch hunt. It's a hoax. I'm too busy to watch it. So I'm sure I'll get a report. There's nothing. I have not been briefed, no. There's nothing there. I see they're using lawyers that are television lawyers. They took some guys off television, you know. I'm not surprised to see it because Schiff can't do his own questions.
More from our correspondent on Capitol Hill, Chris Buckler.
I think we've heard a lot of this before because we know from behind in the closed door hearings that took place with these two top US diplomats both saying that as far as they were concerned, they had concerns. I think truthfully for the American public, they will have heard a lot of this before. There were a couple of nuggets of new information and new allegations made. For example, this suggestion that President Trump had called the US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, and essentially said to him, how are the investigations going? Is there a push for these investigations? And afterwards, it was alleged by this member of Bill Taylor, this US diplomat, his staff allegedly said that as far as he was concerned, Gordon Sondland had suggested that he was interested not in Ukraine, but in terms of pushing this investigation into his political rival, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter. But that will be something that the president says he's not that concerned about. In fact, he said it was just more second-hand information, and that Mr. Sondland had made clear that there was no quid pro quo and that he knew nothing about it. The other bit of information, I suppose, that stands out from those hours of testimony was the suggestion that Rudy Giuliani was not asking questions in Ukraine about promoting US interests, but rather trying to dig dirt on Joe Biden and his son.
That's Chris Buckler. And just for clarity, Rudy Giuliani is the president's personal lawyer. Let's stay in Washington because Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been holding talks at the White House with Donald Trump. The two leaders are said to have made progress on a Turkey-US trade deal, as well as steps to resolve tensions over the war in Syria. More details from our correspondent, Ali McBull.
The timing of this visit is unseemly to many, with Donald Trump welcoming to Washington the man whose forces attacked a neighboring country, leaving hundreds dead and many thousands displaced. It was President Trump's decision to withdraw US troops from northern Syria that in effect gave President Erdogan the green light to invade. But speaking in the Oval Office, Donald Trump said pundits who'd previously criticized his move had now realized he'd done the right thing. President Erdogan reiterated his aim to use the invaded areas in Syria to rehouse refugees. There has been some pushback from the US Congress against Donald Trump's support of his Turkish counterpart. But in an unusual move, the president invited Republicans who'd been critical to meet the Turkish leader, in a sense acting as a peace broker between them.
Ali McBall. Colin Kaepernick is one of the biggest names in American football, despite the fact he's not played professionally since 2016. That was the year he began kneeling during the national anthem to protest against what he saw as racial injustice in the United States. But now he could be getting a chance to play again. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
If you go to a sports game in the US, whether it's baseball, basketball, hockey, or American football, most will start with a rendition of the national anthem. Not just in professional games either. You'll also hear the Star Spangled Banner before sports events at colleges and schools. Back in 2016, Colin Kaepernick was playing for the San Francisco 49ers in the NFL and started a movement that empowered some and enraged others, including President Trump. Kaepernick began a silent demonstration, kneeling during the national anthem to protest against racism and cases of police brutality against minorities. Others soon joined him, including athletes from other sports, who wanted to take a stand and show solidarity. But Kaepernick hasn't played since the 2016 season, and many people, including the athlete himself, say it's nothing to do with his ability and all to do with the protest. The soccer player Megan Rapinoe, who joined the kneeling protest, said Kaepernick's career had suffered because of it.
We still have Colin Kaepernick who's not playing, and I did the same thing that he did in kneeling. So shout out to Colin Kaepernick, everything that he does.
Colin Kaepernick accused NFL owners of conspiring not to hire him and finally reached a settlement with them in February this year. But this weekend could mark the start of his return to the NFL. He's been invited to Atlanta for a workout session on the football field this Saturday. All 32 NFL teams have been invited to watch, so there's a chance one of them could sign him in the future. Kaepernick, who's made no secret of his desire to return to the NFL, says he's in shape and ready for the weekend.
Charlotte Gallagher. More Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. As we record this podcast, at least 23 are reported to have died in the territory. The latest round of violence began when Israel assassinated a senior Islamic Jihad commander, Baha Abu al-Attar. In response, Palestinian militants launched hundreds of rockets into Israel, with dozens injured there. Donald McIntyre is author of the book Gaza, Preparing for Dawn. So how far does he think? Is this a fight between the Islamic Jihad group and Israel? Or does it also involve the dominant power in Gaza, Hamas?
Up to now, I would say almost invariably, when there have been attacks by a faction other than Hamas on Israel, rocket attacks, Israel said it is holding Hamas entirely responsible as the de facto government in Gaza and has simply taken out Hamas sites and sometimes some people as well. On this occasion, very notably, it has not done that and it's confined its attacks to Islamic Jihad, and it seems to be quite anxious to prevent Hamas from joining in, as it were. So, I mean, I think that is a significant departure from the past.
And equally, how far, I mean, despite the rhetoric that one would expect in terms of Hamas saying Israel will pay, does Hamas view Islamic Jihad as a rival?
It's a competitor, colleague organisation, if you like, and so it is to some extent a rival. I think the main point is that unlike Hamas, Islamic Jihad is not responsible for the welfare of 2 million people as its, as I say, de facto government. And I think Hamas probably, under its present Gaza leadership of Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh, is not anxious to turn this into a full-scale confrontation, which it knows very well the population, majority of the population of Gaza do not want. They've got enough problems without yet another war. So I think they are trying to keep out of it. However, it is going to be a dilemma for them if this escalates or is protracted for a very long period, because obviously there will be militants within Hamas saying, why aren't we backing up Islamic Jihad?
So at the moment, it's sensitively balanced from the Gaza side. From the Israeli side, there are some people wondering, you know, how far this timing of this assassination has to do with the political machinations there.
Yes. I mean, on the whole, Netanyahu has not usually mixed security and politics. However, it was fairly widely reported before the September election that he had considered in the run-up to the election an attack on Gaza, which did seem to be to inflate his image in the run-up to that election. Now, on that occasion, the military and the intelligence services seem to have acted as a restraining factor. This time, they have assured the Israeli public that there was a good operational reason for this assassination of Abu al-Atta, and that seems to be true. On the other hand, I think you can never completely separate the political from the security. And obviously, at a time when Israel is in this curious position of not really having a stable government and the attempts are being made to get it, it is possible that Netanyahu thinks that a slightly longer engagement would enhance his image as Mr. Security and make it more difficult, or at least easier, for him to impose terms on his potential coalition partners, namely, especially the ex-chief of staff, Benny Gantz.
Donald McIntyre talking to the BBC's Tim Franks. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, just how essential is coffee to the Swiss way of life?
The Swiss, who are among the world's biggest coffee drinkers, consuming a staggering 8 kilograms each a year, disagree. A national emergency without the national drink is, it seems, unthinkable.
In Bolivia, thousands of supporters of the former president Evo Morales have marched in the capital, La Paz, to demand his return to power. Mr. Morales was granted political asylum by Mexico after the Bolivian military asked him to stand down. The country's interim president, Jeanine Añez, has addressed the country on national television, but she's already facing a crisis, as Will Grant reports from La Paz.
The woman whose supporters say is the interim president of Bolivia, Jeanine Añez, addressed the nation with a call for calm. There should be a peaceful transition following the resignation of President Evo Morales, she said, following a disputed vote count and days of violent protests. However, even as she was speaking, the parliament building she was in was surrounded by angry pro-Morales protesters. They had marched from the former president's stronghold of El Alto, the city above La Paz, into the capital to demand that she stand down. Thousands of indigenous people, agricultural workers, coca growers and campesinos filled one of the city's main focal points, closing roads and shutting down traffic as they walked. As tensions grew, riot police fired on the crowd with tear gas. The protesters are furious about the nature of President Morales' resignation, which they say amounted to a coup by the military, and the subsequent appointment of Jeanine Añez as interim leader. There wasn't a quorum for the parliamentary session to recognise her as president, and the debate over who should succeed Mr. Morales was almost non-existent. Meanwhile, as the argument over her legitimacy continues, she has announced a new military high command in an effort to shore up the armed forces.
Will Grant. Over the last couple of years in Saudi Arabia, things have changed for the better, for the most part, for women. They've been allowed to drive and apply for passports for the first time. So when an online video from the state security agency described feminism as extremism and said homosexuality and atheism were dangerous ideas, it seemed to run counter to the move towards social liberalism. After widespread criticism, the government now says the video was a mistake. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, is in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. He told me more about what was in the video.
It explains that feminism, homosexuality and atheism can, when taken to extreme, be almost equivalent to jihadism as a threat to Saudi society. Now, that's a message which isn't really in line with the way that the Saudi authorities want to present their country these days. They're trying to open up to the world, trying to show that women particularly are being given much more opportunity. So it was quite quick after the denunciations that this created online. I think that some human rights agencies have lodged their displeasure. But the state security presidency issued a pretty strong apology, saying that this came not officially from them, but from an account that was being managed by individuals, that that is going to be sorted out, and that the mistake won't be repeated. Also, it went on, this statement. There was at the same time an article in a local newspaper which suggested that feminism could be punished, again, when taken to an extreme, with imprisonment and flogging. Now, the state security agency said that it was considering legal action against the newspaper for this. The fact is that there are women in prison or released on bail while they're awaiting trial who essentially have been detained for their feminism, for fighting for women's rights, the right to drive, for example, and some have alleged that they were tortured in prison. So, you know, this isn't a fantasy. This is something which has essentially happened in Saudi Arabia and is happening.
Said that there's been a backtrack with regards to feminism, not over homosexuality.
No, it doesn't get a mention. When we're talking about homosexuality and atheism, we're talking about things where there are much greater taboos in a way. I mean, feminism is in one way quite out of a question here, but you're seeing men and women mixing freely, easily in ways they never did before, leaders of industry, leaders of companies who are women. That has crossed a threshold. Obviously, there are still many, many issues with that, but that's gone far further than obviously any open talk of homosexuality or atheism.
Sebastian Usher. German media say 9 suspected Islamic State supporters are to be allowed to go free once they're sent back to the country from Turkey this week. Security sources say there is insufficient evidence to arrest or charge them. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Berlin was caught off guard by Turkey's announcement on Monday that it would start sending Islamic State suspects back where they came from. 7 of the 9 expected back in Germany this week are from one family. The father is an Iraqi with German citizenship. Intelligence sources think he tried to join IS fighters in Syria this year. The family has been held in Izmir in Turkey since March. They could return home to Hildesheim in central Germany, where a local mosque has long been seen as a hotbed of militant Islam. The 2 other returnees are IS wives. One, who says she's widowed, told a television interviewer she expected to serve time in prison on her return. But security sources say there's not enough evidence to hold any of them. The Justice Minister, Christina Lambrecht, says they can be electronically tagged.
Mike Sanders. It's been an annual tradition in Japan since 1952, but now the Cherry Blossom Party is under threat after the government was forced to cancel next year's event following allegations of corruption. I got more details from our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Brister.
You point out there that this annual event has been taking place in a Tokyo park since 1952, but actually the art of looking at flowers has been going on far longer, for many centuries, the 8th century, in actual fact, when the emperor started doing it, the court followed on, and then later on, ordinary people. And every year, this is a massive, massive deal in Japan. People wait for the cherry blossom to emerge. It lasts for just a week or two, and they dash out to their local park or scenic spot to look at these flowers and the great wave of white and pink bloom that they create. The party we're talking about, this one, it's for the great and the good in Japan, a way for them to be honoured for their achievements over the past year. And the government invited all kinds of people, maybe 18,000 actually came this year. The suggestion is, though, that the current government is using it as a way not to reward people who've had genuine achievements, but their own supporters. It's like patronage, a mild form of corruption.
Yeah, it seems that way. And the cabinet secretary said, look, we've listened to various opinions. And yeah, we did invite 850 supporters from the constituency of the prime minister of the ruling party. So they seem to be holding their hands up and saying, yeah, it was a bit of cronyism here.
They've got themselves into a little bit of a tangle over this one, because there were suggestions that the government had devised special lists of people they wanted to go. The government has said it can't release the lists. One department said it had thrown them away. Another department said it contained personal information. But then under questioning, a couple of ministers, the health and the education ministry, admitted that some of their supporters had been invited, although they weren't exactly sure why they'd been invited. Now the cabinet secretary has come out and said next year this event just won't take place. So yes, it it appears to acknowledge that something might have gone on, or at least the publicity surrounding this is just too much for them to hold the event again next year.
Michael Bristow, what happens to migrants from West Africa who risk everything to try to cross the Mediterranean to Europe and eventually, often after repeated attempts, give up and return home? About 3,000 of them have returned to Sierra Leone in the last few years. Tim Hewell reports from the capital, Freetown, on one young woman's story.
I'm afraid to go and see my mommy. I'm afraid to see my aunt, my elder brother. Tell me, you should not even come home.
2 years ago, Fatmata Bangura set off from her home in Sierra Leone on the perilous journey that many young West Africans have attempted across the Sahara, hoping to start a new life in Europe. She never got there. She was imprisoned and enslaved by traffickers, and like most illegal migrants, she eventually turned back. But now her family's rejected her. It's not just that she's a failure. She's a thief.
My mother said he never brought me up to steal, and then I steal from my auntie, so she don't want to see me.
She funded her journey with 25 million leones, back then more than $4,000, that she stole from her aunt, her mother's sister. Now her aunt's trading business is ruined.
Before you took the money, did you think about whether it was very selfish of you to steal from her?
Well, I'm not a selfish person. If I had succeeded by going to Europe, I decided that I'll triple the money, I'll take good care of my aunt and my mom.
Packed into this room, there are dozens and dozens of young people.
This is the headquarters of a voluntary group called Advocacy Network Against Illegal Migration that tries to support young people who've returned from abroad, including many of the 3,000 or so who tried to get to Europe and failed. Nearly all those that I meet funded the journey by stealing from their families. People have heard so much now about how illegal migration can end in slavery or death that many families would refuse now to raise money to send a child abroad. So it's simpler not to ask. But Fatmata's mother now feels betrayed by her daughter. There's someone translating for me from Creole, the Sierra Leonean language.
What she's trying to say, she don't even want to see Fatmata. She will see Fatmata, it will end in the police station.
It will end in the police station?
Yeah.
25 million!
They put an enmity between me and my sister.
The whole family is broken up now because Fatmata's aunt thinks wrongly that Fatmata's mother connived in the theft.
I've been hearing that Fatmata is around Freetown, but I don't really want to see Fatmata because I'm in serious pain. I'm in pain.
Fatmata has come back deeply traumatised by her journey, with no job and no family to talk to. She hasn't even seen her daughter, now 8, since before she left.
I can't even go and see my baby. I only see the pictures. But I can't go there to see her because I have nothing to give to her when I go there, so I can't. I was so happy to come back, but I wish I did not. The stigma is killing me slowly.
Fatmata Bangura, ending that report by Tim Hewell. Many people rely on it when waking up in the morning. Others say they simply wouldn't survive without it. But would you really consider coffee an emergency essential? Well, a row is brewing in Switzerland over government plans to get rid of the country's emergency supply of coffee. The Swiss store items, including basic foodstuffs, to last the population for at least 3 months. And now the government thinks coffee should no longer be on that list. Many disagree, as Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
The Swiss are nothing if not well prepared. Sirens tested once a year, a nuclear bunker for every household, and tons of stockpiled food, fuel and medicines. The strategy evolved out of two world wars, when neutral Switzerland, surrounded by conflict, could not feed itself. But now the government wants to abandon its coffee stockpile. Should war or disaster strike, the thinking goes, coffee is not essential to life. The Swiss, who are among the world's biggest coffee drinkers, consuming a staggering 8 kilograms each a year, disagree. A national emergency without the national drink is, it seems, unthinkable. After a storm of protest, the government has promised to reconsider. And it's likely the 15,000 tons of coffee will stay in the warehouses, alongside the sugar, the flour and the heating oil.
Imogen Folks. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Before I go, we're coming up to Happy News Pod time, which will celebrate the small but positive things that have happened this year in your lives. We'd like to hear from you. Just record a sentence and tell us who you are and where you're from and what was the thing you achieved, and then send it as an email attachment to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.